in my creative journey, if you will, like that's where you really grow, is like knowing what you're going to do before it even happens.
Welcome to the Zero Quit Podcast, where I bring you candid conversations with elite athletes, entrepreneurs, specialists, and other creatives. I'm your host, Brock Covington, and through these dialogues, you will hear powerful stories and practical advice that will help you live a more active and intentional life. If you enjoy the show, be sure to subscribe and share it with a friend. What's going on, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Zero Quit Podcast. Today, I have on Andrew Shelley. He is a videographer, editor, and owner of South Shell Creative. Despite being based in New York City, he's traveled the country, filmed for a variety of different brands, athletes, and obviously is the man when it comes to content at 10,000. How are you doing, man?
I'm good, Brock. How are you doing?
Doing good. It's bright and early. I had you walk into to work early on a Friday morning. It's probably frigidly cold in New York. What's it like these days?
Yeah, it's like, it was probably a nice brisk 30-something, or 30, but it's good. I'm actually only outside for a quick, like, 20 yards and then just hop in the subway, so it's not always that bad.
How is subway life? I've never lived in, like, that big. Well, I haven't lived really. I guess I lived in a minor city with Richmond, but I never had to really deal with public transport or anything like that. What is that day-to-day like? Do you like the city life? I know you went to school in College of Charleston, but did you grow up in Southeast? Or?
So I grew up in Long Island. About an hour from New York City.
Gotcha.
But I didn't really, I would go in every once in a while, but I was never really like a city person. So
yeah,
I've been in the city now for two years. Gotcha. It's different. Yeah, the subway is, especially in New York City, like there's definitely some creatures. I'm a big believer in, I think everyone should at least, almost like a draft, I think you should do 1 year in New York City.
You gotta do at least one tour in the subway.
Yeah, like, you know how some countries will make you do, like,
yeah,
in Israel, you do, like, a year. Yeah, you need, like, 1 year in New York City just to ground you.
Yeah.
I think it could be really good for a lot of people, so.
Yeah, for sure. You definitely get, like you said, there's a bunch of different creatures out there. The only thing I could, like, maybe relate it to, which hopefully this doesn't sound too bad, is I think of, like, Walmarts. Almost any state you go in, you go into, like, a Walmart, you get, like, a wide variety of what an American can look like, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what I think of with the subway. But as it pertains to you specifically, really excited to chat because, obviously, we've been in contact for, I want to say, like, over 2 years at this point, and you know, been in person at different places, whether it be Chicago or Leadville. And although I don't feel like you post as much personal content as maybe you'd like to, I see the magic, I see the mindset behind it. So I'm excited to dig into some of this stuff. The best place to start would probably be to ask, what drew you into creative work in the beginning? Were you always this way as a kid? Did you always have, you know, the camcorder in your hand, or how'd you get started?
Yeah, so I would say I traditionally didn't as a kid. I mean, I think I picked up my first camera, like true camera, sophomore year of college. My mom actually bought me a camera. But as like a kid, I always loved movies. You know, my dad would always show me. He's more of an older guy, so he'd always show me movies. I always grew up watching movies. Specific, and then like sports docs I was like obsessed with as a kid, so I think it was ingrained that in there. And then when I kind of got my first camera, just like a lot of people's creative journeys, you just you know you're taking photos of like whatever you can, and then that kind of evolved.
Anything creative before that? Like, was there any kind of artistic style or outlet, writing or anything that was going on there? Or really was the camera the genesis of you saying, hey, I can be the creator more than the consumer?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I drew a lot as a kid. Like, that was probably the only, like, real creative outlet growing up. And then, yeah, I think it just, when I first got my camera, kind of evolved into something more. It definitely took, like, a couple years. I'll go quickly through how it started. Like, it was more of a photo based. And so I think I was a sophomore in college studying marketing business, pretty like over. Like, didn't really know what I wanted to do. Like a lot of people.
Like most kids. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially when you're in Charleston too, you know, there's a bunch of distractions, and it was just a fun time. But yeah, it started off just taking pictures of my friends and, you know, going on trips and whatnot. And then was like, oh, I can kind of make money around this. So I started doing weddings, because that's mm-hmm. hot spot, especially in Charleston. So that was my first real start into like the business side.
Mm-hmm.
And then so I did that for about like 2 years. And then I quickly was like, ooh, I don't know. I knew that there was opportunity to make money and like have this be a career. I was still like hesitant. Is this more of like a hobby type stuff like that?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I quickly like fell out of love with weddings. It's good money maker, but it's not super fulfilling, especially for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah. And then I would say about when I graduated college, looking at marketing jobs and in the digital field, it just nothing really hit. I was like, I can't really be behind a desk. It's just not for me. Mm-hmm. So that's where I kind of shifted towards more video. I think I just always loved video more. It just clicked for me. So
more dynamic, I'd say, right?
Yeah.
I was going to say you referenced that you went to school for marketing, because that's what I picked up on quickly was, you know, hey, you didn't go to school for film or video work or anything like that. What has been your method of self-education, and what are your thoughts on that idea of, hey, I didn't go to school for this. I don't have maybe any formalized credentials, but clearly, you know, your work can speak for itself. I think a lot of freelancers nowadays, you know, you'd rather hire someone like yourself, or like a Daniel Schiffer or something like that, or Peter McKinnon that maybe didn't go to school, but hey, you know, look at the work they can do, rather than the credentials they may or may not have.
Yeah, I would say where I learned was, it was like YouTube University for about like a 2-year, 3-year gap. I was just like ingrained. That was like you said, those names, those were actually like the Daniel Schiffers, the Peter McKinnons,
the every single
every single tutorial, like and it was just absorbing that almost to a fault. Like I would watch so much, and there was a period of time where I wasn't like actually doing, I was still doing, but looking back now, it's like you need to just get out in the field and like actually do it. That's what I think.
I was gonna say, because I sorry to cut you off there.
No,
I want you to run with it, but I was gonna say I see that so much with anything. I mean, you think of fitness. I remember when I was starting with bodybuilding, and it could go with other people, with runners. They, you know, absorb all the material, and that's great. You could know everything, but until you actually do it, you know, it means nothing until you actually put it into practice and find what works out for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The debate between like film school or not, I think I'm not going to sit here and say that like you don't have to go to like you definitely don't. But there are so many people that have. And it's also a completely different industry. It depends on really what you want to do. Like, if you're really into like narrative work and like documentary work, there's so many valuable things that you learn at film school that you probably couldn't. And I've talked to some people in film school now too, and I think film schools in general are like shifting back to what you said is more doing, like it's not just like in a classroom studying like film and what it's on productions and like putting those. Yeah. So
I'm guessing a lot of the advantage would be the access to extremely expensive equipment that maybe you can't, you know, buy and practice with yourself. And then obviously this goes with any field, but like the networking opportunities, right, that you gain from, let's say, going to prestigious school or, you know, having some different friendships or internships from that. While you were starting to decipher whether this was a hobby for you or if it was something you wanted to pursue, you were in the state of limbo. What was your main job or maybe couple jobs that you were working as you started to build up this freelance business?
In college, I worked for like kind of like an entrepreneur, and he had a bunch of in Charleston. He had a bunch of different businesses, and I helped him do kind of the creative for a lot of it. So, I mean, he had like a software company. He had a he actually had like some dropship company. So, essentially, just making graphic designs. I would do emails, websites. Like, I was the jack of all trades. Yeah. Obviously, looking back, it was probably all just like very average work. So I did that, but it was he was instrumental. Like, he was very he was a true entrepreneur. Helped me understand like how to make this freelance stuff work, how to take loans out for gear, how to like price certain projects and whatnot, and really understand the business side, because I think that's, I mean, if not, that's like half the battle. So that was very instrumental. And then after college, I also worked for a like an IV clinic, more of a performance medicine, if you will. You could say like it was a doctor down in Charleston, kind of the in the biohacking space. So he would do a lot of like IV drips, peptides.
Before it was so hot, I guess.
So I did creative work for them as well.
Gotcha. So let's dig into the actual video work itself a little bit, because I was trying to search for the post so I could reference it, but I think it was a story that you kind of talked about of how to develop a story and a narrative within a video. So maybe you can kind of reference that or expand upon it. What is your approach to storytelling, which is perhaps maybe a little bit broad? I'm sure it varies from project to project, but at least what are maybe the key elements and the foundational pieces that you think of when it comes to storytelling through video?
Yeah, I think I know what post you're talking about. It's like the framework of a story, and I'm forgetting the video that I watched. I mean, it's pretty, a lot of people will say this, like, it, so to break down a story, I think there's like, there's four parts. It's, so one is the question. It's like, you start with the question, and you could call that the hook. And that's pretty much establishing like, what the story is going to be about, essentially. And then comes, usually in the traditional, it comes some, I think they call it, it's confidence is the next one. And that's like the build up. So take a subject, you know, take the hero journey or whatnot.
Take Joey, for example,
Joey's a great one, because I think I used that for his Leadville one. And that was like a 90-second piece. So it was a super short, but you can actually tell a decent story. So it's Joey is the question, and it starts off the hook. I believe he's like, we're going to run
100 miles. You know, 100 there's like miles, the drone shot. You get the energy. You hear the gun go off. Yeah. That establishing hook.
Yeah. And then the confidence, showing Joey, showing you guys, showing the laughter. He's like, oh, this is fun. We got to do this again. Like blah, 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 rah, 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 rah. And then I think it cuts. He's about to take off up Hope Pass, and then it goes dark. And then that's the third part, is the conflict, showing your subject, your hero, whatever it is, showing them in a low point. And then that's when it cuts, and then he's smiling, blah, blah, blah. It cuts, and then he's like in tears when he saw you guys back. So it kind of brings him back down to earth, showing the struggle, showing the uncertainty. He's going to be able to do this. And then you slowly build that back up. And that's the fourth one is resolution.
And I guess it's not anything too crazy or unorthodox. It's something we're quite familiar with in movies that we've seen. But I think the interesting approach you have to take with short form content is trying to implement those same trajectories and principles into a minute reel or 90 second or whatever it is. I think that becomes the challenge with events that you filmed, because obviously you've done, let's say, stuff that's product focused with 10,000, then you've done things in the field. What is the stress, or how do you manage the stress of trying to capture an athletic event in the moment, when obviously you can't tell someone to go up Hope Pass again real quick so you can get the shot? You know, what is How do you handle knowing, hey, I got to make sure I'm in the right spot, I get this angle, I capture this moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's my favorite part. It's definitely a challenge, but it's like capturing in real time. I think there's a bunch of aspects. One, it's just like anything, like it takes practice. I think if you're doing, I mean, take a race, for example, like for me, it's a lot of pre-prep. So it's a lot of.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. Is it thinking about, you know, where you need to be for X point when, you know, the runner or the lift is being achieved? Like, yeah, that pre-plan, the preparation.
Yeah, it's getting a plan, writing down. And that even goes for, like you said, when you can control the variables, like in a studio setting, it's still like you need a pre-prep. I think that's where in my creative journey, if you will, like that's where you really grow, is like knowing what you're going to do before it even happens. Because then you're prepared and like the variables don't change as much. So like take a race. Yeah. Knowing what points do you want to get? If it is a race, like what are the crucial points? Whether that be on the actual course or, hey, this is going to be a hard section. Like this is where a point where I'm going to be able to show conflict in the subject. And it is also being able to, I guess, keep up. If it is a race, you know, travel light. I think a lot of, like, me especially, you know, we want to gear up and have these huge rigs, but it's like, yeah. You don't have the opportunity to miss that moment. So it's like travel light. Really, the visuals are one thing, but you need to make sure you get that audio bite. Like you need to always, I wouldn't say always be rolling, but I try to be, and especially in those seats, because you never know when you're going to get like that nugget that's just going to like make or break a video.
With the work you've done with 10,000 specifically, or it could go for other brands too, what is your approach or the challenges of dealing with content you've shot and you know how they're going to fit together, maybe how you'll make a cohesive end result out of it, versus getting, let's say, content from someone else and having to collaborate in that way? You know, what are the some, you know, because you may get footage that's not up to snuff, or, you know, it's a short clip and you got to kind of make do. What are some of the strategies or things you think about to pull it all together, if that makes sense?
Yeah. So if I'm not shooting or I'm getting content from someone else, again, hopefully I'm aware that I'm going to be getting content from another like freelancer or whatnot. Mm-hmm. So then I can, again, pre-prep, hopefully talk to him or her and kind of walk through, you know, what we need to get. But if it is like, if I don't have that ability, one, it's putting everything on a timeline, cutting it down, like seriously cutting it down, grabbing the selects, you know, building a framework and story around there. And then it's like, you'd be surprised of what other types of elements you can grab from, usually that pertains more to the audio side. So like, if I just have visuals, hey, I can hop on a phone call with whatever, grab some audio pieces. I can take like old footage. Yeah, there's a bunch of different avenues I can take it. But usually, hopefully, we're working with like other solid freelancers. Like they have hopefully they're shooting for an edit too. And I try to take that into account.
Yeah.
To really do them justice. I don't want to just like completely rip the draw cord in there. They're like, hey, you kind of missed the boat. So, but you learn that also over time. There's like, I can take Israel, for example.
Yeah.
And we know him. He does a lot of work with 10,000, a lot of work with other brands. Like he's given me so much footage and projects where I'm editing, but like we have such a good flow. I'll look back and I'm like, okay, I know exactly like what he's trying to do. And he knows.
So building relationship, I guess, with the accessory shooters or whoever's on the job. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
But audio, I would say, is huge. That's like, for me, everything, you know, whether that's music track, dialogue, sound design, I think that is more important than the visuals.
Well, that leads right into a question I had next was, what are those small elements or differences that make a big, or small details, I should say, that make a big difference when it comes to video work? And I think sound design is one of those things that it's not like having a resurgence. It's always been there, but I think more people are paying attention to how little sound effects, or, you know, layering different sound tracks together, whether it is music and then narration, and then, you know, the sound of a cowbell ringing as someone comes into an aid station. You know, what, besides sound design, and maybe you could talk about how that kind of helps tell a narrative and just add depth to the visual. You know, is color grading another detail? What are you thinking about those maybe things that are behind the scenes that the editor handles that the consumer of the video maybe doesn't notice initially, but it does have an impact on their experience?
Yeah, I would say there's a bunch of different elements. I think as an editor, at least my goal is to be almost to be as seamless as possible. Like the best editors ever, you look at, like, even, you know, movie editors, like most of the stuff they're doing, 95% of the people won't notice because it's so good. And it's seamless in that regard. And that can be through sound design. Like you said, if you're adding like a cowbell in the background, or the trees or whatnot, I would say majority of viewers will notice it, but it's going to be subconscious.
Yeah.
Because hopefully the sound design is on point, so where it sounds like it's, you know, seamless. So the visual is pairing with whatever sound design it is and whatnot. And the same thing with, I think, one area with sound design, and I was terrible at it in the beginning too, is adding those like sound effect whooshes and whatnot. And it is cool. It's fun. But it's my goal really is to make it sound seamless. Like if I'm not noticing a whoosh, like like I can hear it, and I'm like, oh, that for me like breaks it. I'm like, oh, that's not too. And it works for some videos, but it's usually most of the time it's just lowering everything, and so it just sounds very like gradual and flawless and whatnot. But yeah, there's a ton of aspects. I think to really elevate videos nowadays, it's like that's 100% a need. Yeah.
Well, one question I want to ask you is kind of maybe you have a particular side of the debate, but what are your thoughts on, let's say, the more basic editing style, very authentic, more realist, I guess, approach of like a Casey Neistat, who's just filming himself walking around. There's not a bunch of swooshing or transitions. It's very natural in that way. Versus, you know, a Sam Colder-like figure who's, you know, masking the transitions and got all these effects, and there's, you know, constant drones and expensive, you know, maybe After Effects added into it. What are your thoughts on balancing the two to where it is a very natural video? I think, honestly, about the video you posted a few weeks back when you went on that trip west, and it was simple. It was a lot of times just a stable tripod shot. But the way you layered it, the different sound design exactly that you use, especially like the sounds of the ocean or the rustling of the trees, that alone, sometimes, you know, peeling back the layers and taking a more reductionist approach to the video makes it more than trying to add too much. Does that make sense? What are your thoughts on that whole ramble I just threw at you?
No, yeah, you're good. I love this topic. I think, like you said, you had Sam Colder and Casey Neistat. I mean, like, you couldn't be more like polar opposites. And, it's great because it's like whatever flavor that you want. And there's no right or wrong, truly. I think I'm like the biggest Casey Neistat stan. So I think for Casey, it works because to him, his first initial is storytelling. That's why it works. Like, he is one of the best storytellers, I think, ever. So he can be more raw, and like the editing style isn't as polished, where Sam Colder, still great storyteller, but you're going to it for more of the visuals. And
could you, if you, to draw like a rough analogy, could you think of it as like Casey Neistat or like the storytelling is, hey, maybe we don't have, you know, the nicest clothes going on here, but the bones, the foundation, the body is there versus with Sam Coulter, maybe, you know, the body's there, but it's not maybe as formed or solidified as it could be. But we're going to throw on a bunch of makeup on the body. We're going to wear the nicest dress. We're going to, you know, add some accessories, some rings to kind of distract you from maybe the potentially what's lacking, or at least isn't to the extent of the Casey's, but you know, we have the layers on top that maybe meet it to the same overall experience, something like that.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think there's also, to Casey's point, and like if you look at what performs on social and whatnot, it's usually like this more native looking content. And by native, I mean like phone video, or just not super polished like camera and whatnot. And I think that it performs well because natively, like I mean, you could take 10,000 for example, like if I have a phone video of Eric Kinman just, you know, on an assault bike, and it's just a one single clip, that usually always performs 10 times better than like a super polished like 8K with, you know, my red camera. And like, and I think because subconsciously some people also are flipping through and they instantly just see that this is more polished and they might think it's like an ad or whatnot. And it's just, you're gone.
Well,
you're gone.
That's something I talked to Jack about months ago when I had him on. I was like, you know, what is 10,000 looking for, and how do they decipher, hey, do we want the natural iPhone looking clips that most people are going to resonate with? They're going to, you know, not subconsciously or, you know, really consciously think it's an ad. Versus the higher quality stuff that they bring on. I mean, they pay you for a reason, right? Because you do amazing work and it looks polished, it looks professional. And that's obviously, you know, a big piece of branding is to look clean and professional, especially if you are a luxury brand or a high-end brand and you're asking people to pay $70 for shorts. You don't want all the photos to be shot on an iPhone. But, you know, a lot of brands are paying me or other people for UGC that isn't overly edited or overly done, you know?
Yeah, I think you got to balance it out, and you got to do both is the real question. But yeah, I know that's been a struggle for me because I love, you know, that polished look. But at the same time, I'm not going to be like an old guy shaking my fist at the clouds. And I'm like, well, why? Like, actually peel back the onion. Like, why is this working? And kind of figure out how to incorporate that. And yeah.
So. Yeah, I think it is a balance of meeting the public and the demand, right? But then part of it, too, is sticking to, you know, why you create what you love to create. You know, like I could do a lot of footage and content on my phone, but I have just mental standards in my mind. I have a comfortability and confidence with my Sony that, hey, I want to shoot everything on this expensive camera I put money into. You know, I want all my reels that I can, I want to be with that. Or, you know, all the photos I shoot have to be high resolution. Mm-hmm. And but at the same time, you know, some things, one, it's difficult to capture in the act. Like if I'm going out on a run myself, I'm not carrying a, you know, 8-10 pound camera with me. So sometimes it's just grab the iPhone, film some clips. And like you said, funny thing enough, it's the less edited stuff. It's like the one or two clips that end up performing way better than the stuff I put hours into. So it's sometimes it's frustrating and demoralizing at times, but you know, it is what it is. When it comes to working with 10,000, I think you came on, you could correct me, roughly around 2 years ago. What has been the balance mentally of knowing you now have this sense of security and comfort? You have a consistent paying job. You have that consistency in your life, right? That paycheck coming in versus freelance has a lot more volatility to it. And it can be high and it can be low depending on the season. Like right now with some of the real estate work I do, obviously it's lower. Now less people are buying during the holidays, less realtors want to make videos about buying or selling. So how do you kind of balance and juggle that, hey, I have this flexibility and freedom with freelancing, but I also like the security, the consistency, tying a little bit of my identity and creation to a brand that I can get behind?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a question I think about constantly. I mean, I've done freelancing. I think it was so long ago that it would like my skills were almost like when I was first starting, I would just take everything under the sun just to, you know,
feed myself.
But I look at it now, I think there's a couple aspects. One, of course, is the financial security. That's, you know, if not the biggest one. Second is working for yourself. I mean, for me, that still is like there's a pride in it. Two, there's a lot more freedom, you know, you make your own hours. I will say a lot of people think that, maybe not a lot of people, but that's not glitz and glam. Like most of the time freelance, you're probably working way more than you would if you had like a 9-to-5 or a traditional
Absolutely.
One.
Yeah.
But there is the freedom of you can make your hours. Like when I freelance, I'd love working at night. Now I'm not really so much a night person. I'm like I'm more creative in the morning, but that's definitely, hey, if you wanted to go work out in the middle of the afternoon, blah, 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 take your own meeting. So that's a huge thing. I think with 10,000, the one part I love the most is I get to create a body of work that's like consistent. I'm working on something, you know, a broader message, like the last 2 years. So for me, that's been able, like I've been able to almost create my own like creative voice in that way. Of course, I'm still making it on brand and whatnot. But whereas freelance, you're definitely working on different projects, which is good, but it could be totally different industries. Like,
yeah,
some people stick to one, but you can lose that like pounding the rock every day. It really has helped me and with my creative and like more just figure out my own like creative voice, if you will. Yeah.
How do you, because I believe you still do some freelance work on the side now, right?
Yeah.
So how do you make that distinction between the work that you do where, you know, I don't know your exact hours, but obviously a large percentage of your time you're doing video work as a job, as a career here, but then you also want to have time for your passions. You still want to have time to have video as something you enjoy to do. And I think sometimes it's hard because they say do what you love and, you know, you won't work a day in your life. It's not entirely true because it can be very tedious. Sometimes working in a field you enjoy can suck the love out of it a little bit. It's like spending too much time with your spouse, you know, as many of us did maybe during the pandemic. You need a little bit of space to breathe, right, so that everything can flourish as it should. How do you balance that distinction? Have you had trouble wanting to pick up a camera out of work?
Yeah, I love the do what you love. There's I was actually listening to like a Chris Williams podcast or whatnot, but he was saying that that's like a flawed way of thinking. It's almost like you should figure out, I forget, I'm gonna probably botch it, but figure out what you love I'm trying to think. What you love to struggle with, or like what you can do for hours on end when like it's gonna suck. But for me, that's but I guess back to your question. For me, like freelancing, while I have this, there's a couple things. One, financially, I can, you know, get a little more money and whatnot. But usually the projects that I'm taking are more for fulfilling like my creative outlet. And it's also, I did say it's nice to work on one, like overall for one brand and create this voice, but it is also nice to get outside the box and work on different projects or different brands to kind of flex that creativity. Like,
Yeah.
I mean, we could take Jack, for instance. I do a lot of work for Dirty Bird Gun Club, which I absolutely love. Like, for me, that's like my sandbox. You know, I can test new techniques or narratives. It's also like, you look at 10,000, you look at, like, they're totally different characteristics. So I love challenging myself in that regard. In terms of your question of, like, is it tough to pick up a camera? Like, do I see this still as a job? I do see it as a job, but I do, like, I mean, I absolutely love it. Like, it is, for me, it is a dream job. I don't take that for granted. There are days where I'm like, oh my gosh, I do not want to do this. But that's with anything. It really is with anything. So,
yeah, I like that you articulated that well, because it is something I've experienced with owning a gym, with the freelance work that I do, with even with like Switchback now. It's, you know, not everything that you, even if it's your own business, even if it's something you love, there are tough days, and it doesn't change your attitude or desire to own the business or do the thing you love. But it's just a recognition that not every day is sunshine, even if it is a, you know, a dream job. I'm sure even like, you know, NBA players sometimes are like, God damn, we got to play another game. So there is no, you don't want to look at job or passion too much with rose tinted glasses, you know. What do you think, in your own experiences and seeing the landscape over the past 2 years, and maybe, you know, stuff you've heard internally, what mistake do you think videographers or brands are making with their content overall? You know, especially when it comes to one thing I think about, maybe this will guide you a little bit with Switchback, is I'm really keen on trying to not focus too much on product. I want to try and push a message of feeling and emotion through the content we shoot, rather than just throwing up a bunch of, you know, Photoshopped images and a splash of orange behind the tub and things like that.
Yeah, I think almost to your Switchback example and other brands, is especially in the organic space, I'll kind of just talk on that and more of like the social media aspect, is to your point, is don't do product. Like, one of, I mean, you look at some of the best brands that do it well, I would say like Red Bull. You look at their, you go to their organic, you will not find a Red Bull can on like any of their stuff. I mean, maybe, but they've been able to grow internationally by showcasing these crazy athletes doing extreme sports and whatnot. And it really doesn't have to do anything with the actual product that they're selling. Sure, there's, you know, space to actually make content around like the actual drink. But it is almost creating this, I don't want to say lifestyle, but for Switchback, it's not just showing the product. It's going to run clubs. It's showing people, like, it is building this community. Like, for 10,000, I try and do this approach. It's not so much like, oh, I need to just show these shorts and blah, blah, blah. It's taking these athletes doing these epic challenges and almost building that persona that when someone sees that, it's like you're selling some sort of vibe. Nike does it well with Just Do It. You know, it's building something more than like when you put on a pair of shorts. It's like, I feel a part of something in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, Simon Sinek has that book. I think it's called Start With Your Why. I haven't read it, but I've seen like TED Talks or speeches on it. And he talks about leading with your why and not like the what. And why brands like Apple do really well is because they start with, hey, we have a culture, a commitment to, you know, innovation, challenging the status quo and all of that. We do that through our, you know, very intuitive, user-friendly you know, advancements in technology and software, we just happen to sell computers. And mm-hmm. so it's like you start with the why your brand is here and trickle down there. You know, Red Bull, to use them, again, we are adventurous, we are thrill seekers, we just happen to sell this drink. Or Switchback, you know, what we're attempting to do through our content and nail better over time is, you know, we are committed to this belief of farther together, of community, mm-hmm. of the power of what running can do, and not what it is maybe just on mere appearance of medals and podiums and race times. And, you know, we just happen to sell electrolytes or hats or running gear. So yeah. It's not an easy thing to do, but I think through the elements we talked about earlier, through proper storytelling and thinking about these elements, you can make your content more than it is on the surface.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And especially when you have a product, like there's so many, all these spaces are so saturated, and it's mm-hmm. really like the product has to be quality and good to even like, that's a baseline, you know, like there's,
yeah.
If you take supplements, for example, like it's a great one. It's like, you know, they have to, that's just
not the
baseline. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or even like workout shorts or workout gear, like,
yeah.
I won't say it's easy to create that, but it's, now there's so many, resources available to us that it's like, yeah, it better not suck. So
mm-hmm.
that's your baseline. And it's like, well, what differentiates you from the rest mm-hmm. of everyone else? And it really is like building that community, telling meaningful stories, I think, because people resonate with other people. I think we're like social creatures. We want to,
yeah.
So pairing that with communities, pairing that with individuals, but doing mm-hmm. it the right way, strategic, make sure it makes mm-hmm. sense, and make sure it's authentic. Don't just like go out, back to your original question is
mm-hmm.
what a brand's doing. Like, don't just do the one-off, like get an influencer, blah, blah, blah. Like, yeah. This is super transactional. It's like build a relationship and have that grow and yeah. whatnot. Yeah, I think that's
yeah. Tricky. I think it's to the aim of the content is to connect, not to sell. Maybe is like yeah. a way to summarize a little bit. And I like that you mentioned it because a lot of brands do, especially in the startup realm, when they have a lot of VC funding, they just throw money at people, you know, like myself or like other people, and. Yeah, you know, it might work in the short term, might draw some awareness, but honestly, one, I don't think it converts that many sales versus what you're pumping into it, depending on who you're paying for. And two, it just looks strange when, mm-hmm. let's say, all these ambassadors you paid for, athletes you paid for, start using a different protein powder or start using a different brand like a couple months later, and it's like, it makes the brand look weird and bad. It makes the influencer look shady, and that's something mm-hmm. I try and protect with my own integrity. But it's definitely slippery. As a creator and creative in general, what are your concerns about the AI space? Now, I'll preface this by saying I think the work that you know you do or I do or whomever that does similar work, it obviously is dependent upon creativity. And what can AI not quite do to the extent, right, is have that creative touch. It's very good at monkey tasks or automations, but, you know, to add a flavor to this or that, it's not getting, you know, quite there. But what I will say, I don't know if you've seen it or played with it more than I have, but I think it's Adobe Firefly, right, has, you know, it can drop in a bunch of stuff, B-roll, sound stuff, you know, obviously Premiere, I think, has a plugin that'll auto-caption everything and can chop things up. What are your concerns, especially with where it is today and maybe where it could be in 5-6 years? Like, are, you know, 10,000 going to have you chop up a reel anymore if it can just do it for them, you know?
Yeah, yeah, it's a great debate. I think there will always be tools, like editing tools or these tools that come in to play that make it easier for the average person to create or whatnot, or make it faster. Mm-hmm. We live in a world where it's just faster, faster, faster. So I think the AI topic is, the way I see it is creators are now just going to have to, and they are just using that to their advantage. I mean, you look at some of the AI software, it's like the podcast AI editing, where it edits it in like, I don't know, a clip. And originally that would take a human like an hour or whatnot. I think where maybe it gets dicey is just the overall content is, I don't know, it probably just loses substance. It loses that human touch. I'll talk maybe more on like the actual editing concept. I think editing in itself, in its nature, is a very human, very
subjective.
Yeah, it's subjective. Like people, there's obviously editing techniques and but if you look at, if you talk to some of the best editors like in the movie thing, it's really like a feel. It's like a feel thing. It's very subjective, but like the flow of it is, I don't know, it just has like a human element to it that I'm not sure. I think AI will be able to definitely pick up on it, but it'll probably be that like 10-20% of stuff. And again, it's more just back to the human. Creators are going to have to get more unique, and it'll just, again, raise the bar of like what stands out. And I think that's always going to happen.
Yeah, it makes me think of, because I love to tie philosophical concepts to real life as much as I can. but it reminds me of this one passage from Pascal's Pensées, where he talks about the mathematical mind versus the intuitive mind. And so basically, an easy way to think of it is, we're kind of describing it in like an editing realm, but if you think of it like a chef, the mathematical mind is going to be able to create the consistent cake every single time. It's going to follow the recipe to a T. The method is very specific, and it's going to be done every single time. It has that consistency to it. Versus the intuitive mind is the, you know, it's the Bobby Flay. He's like doing a pinch of salt. He's you know, mixing things up. He's going off intuition and feel. And it won't always be consistent. It won't always be better or even up to par with the mathematical mind. But there is that, through that inconsistency, through that artistic flair, they're going to be able to create something higher and better that systematizing and methodizing everything will not be able to achieve. And so I think that's what you're hitting on, is the idea that there is a level of, okay, we can objectify everything and make it down to a science, but at some point there is that subjectivity, especially when it comes to art, that is not going to be able to achieve or be able to be achieved through AI. Last question I have for you, speaking back to that video you had posted a couple months back, and you get a little hiatus from work, vacation, and you get to travel west. And you spoke about, you know, having this bit of like an innate desire to kind of chase the mountains, to get out in nature more. Where do you think that desire originates? What were your takeaways from your experience out there?
Yeah. For me, I mean, I love the mountains. Like, I don't know why. I grew up in Long Island, and then I went to school in Charleston, which both those places are probably as flat as loose leaf. So, but I've just always been drawn to them. I love just staring at them. But to answer your question, I'm not sure. I think for me, especially living in the city, like, it is 100% just it kind of breaks the silence. Go out, get some fresh air. It is chaos, and I call it controlled chaos in New York City. But you know, you're around people all the time.
Yeah.
So when I get to go out and travel and whatnot, it really is just allows me to like reset.
Gives your mind a break.
Yeah. It
calms you.
Stay present and whatnot. I think also just being outside, being in nature, always gets the creative juices flowing, gets like inspiration, you know, makes running better. I love.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Love. Yeah. Like, I mean, running on the West Side Highway in the city is always great, but it's just so much better when you can just like hit the trails and whatnot. So for me, that's like just like a need. Like I probably need to do that every few months.
Yeah.
And yeah, that just helps me mentally stay sane. It's also gorgeous, like some of the places, you know, so.
Yeah, I experienced that a lot. So I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, lived there for 20 years before moving out this way. There's some rolling hills of Virginia, but it's generally flat, like you said, as well. And, you know, the biggest thing isn't just seeing the mountains here every day in Colorado Springs, but it's more so what I don't see. It's I don't see skyscrapers. I don't see, you know, constant traffic, at least where I live. I'm a little bit on the outskirts of the city. I see a lot of open space and land. And I think it's like the underlying feelings of tranquility, the underlying feelings of openness and potential that kind of underlie those landscapes. And it's a slower pace of life, because as much as you can, you know, meditate and try and do all these mindful practices in New York, I mean, it is a hectic place. It is a busy place. It's constant going. There's constant things to do. There's, you know, transportation. You got to be on your P's and Q's walking around the city, I'm imagining. And there's a little bit of like a deep breath you can take maybe when you're out west or just in a less chaotic environment. So I definitely resonate with that. Where can people find you, Andrew? So, you know, obviously you do primarily work with 10,000, but it, you know, Instagram, maybe you have another place where you upload some fun short films or projects. Where can people find your work?
I would just say, yeah, Instagram. It's my name, so it's Andrew. The last name is Shelley, EY, and then I believe underscore. That's where I don't post that much. I probably should post more.
Post more. We want it.
10,000. What's some other places? Yeah, Dirty Bird. That's a lot of work goes on there. But yeah, I would say mostly it's just that platform for me. I try and stay. that's enough for me.
Yeah.
I try and keep it simple, but yeah.
Awesome, man. Well, I love it. I love chatting. I love connecting further with you, because it's good to have, you know, more of a conversation than brief DM or, you know, seeing you while you're in action. So I appreciate it. I look forward to catching up with you at some point, I'm sure, in 2024. And if you guys enjoyed the podcast, make sure to share it, give Andrew a follow, and I'll catch you guys in the next one.